This is the Music History In-Depth podcast for May 15th through the 21st. On this week's show, a man goes from being a star to a megastar in one night, the world loses a promising young man, and we celebrate the birthday of a man who changed music. This show goes more in depth about some of the events that we put on our daily podcast, the Music History Today podcast, which drops every single day, including weekends, wherever you get your podcast from. Now, on to this week's episode. First, let's talk about a TV special. The Motown 25 special was recorded on March 25th, 1983 in Pasadena, California. No one knew it at the time, but one performance during that special would electrify the world. The special itself was pretty good. A lot of the Motown greats were there. Stevie Wonder, Marvin Gaye, Junior Walker, Mary Wells, and Martha Reeves were there. The night had a lot of reunions. For instance, Diana Ross performed with the Supremes, Smokey Robinson performed with the Miracles, and a boy group got back together. This particular boy group performed a medley of their biggest hits, and then they all left the stage except for the lead singer. The lead singer then performed a hit off of his latest solo album, which was the only non-Motown song performed that night during the special. About midway through the song, he spun around, slid backwards, and spun three times. The crowd went wild, for they had just seen Michael Jackson of the boy group The Jackson 5 perform the moonwalk for the very first time to the song Billie Jean. Now, the moonwalk itself was not a new dance. People had been doing versions of it for years. In fact, if you watch old videos of 80s b-boy breakdancers, they did what was known back then as sidestepping. Michael actually learned how to do it from two dancers who had done it on the TV show Soul Train. He just took it to a whole other level and did his version of it. By the time this special was recorded, his album Thriller had been out for about 5 months and was doing okay but not spectacular on the pop charts. The first single, The Girl Is Mine, with Paul McCartney, had performed pretty well. Billie Jean was the second single and was finally getting some airplay on MTV, but it wasn't a huge smash hit quite yet. Also, there was no internet to speak of at the time and no social media, so word hadn't gotten out about Michael's performance in March. That all changed on May 16, 1983, when the Motown special premiered on NBC television, which was a Sunday night. I know, because I was watching. Before that night, Michael was a popular artist with a bunch of hits with his brothers, the Jackson 5, and a few solo hits like Don't Stop Till You Get Enough and Off the Wall. After that night, Michael Mania was born. All anybody could talk about was Michael's performance the next day, and especially the moonwalk. Billie Jean quickly went up the charts to number one. His follow-up, Beat It, boosted by an extremely popular music video, became another number one smash. The album Thriller started selling like crazy. Some weeks it sold over a million copies per week. In 1984, Michael won 8 Grammy Awards for the album, at that time a record number. Today, Thriller is the biggest selling album of all time worldwide, with sales of 65 million worldwide, a record that will probably never be broken. And it all started on the night of May 16, 1983, when the Motown 25 TV special was shown on NBC television. Next, there are certain times when politics and music collide. Most times, it's when something bad happens. For instance, when a mass shooting, a suicide, or violent crime occurs, politicians will usually blame alternative, heavy metal, or hip-hop for the trouble, instead of the underlying conditions. Music tends to be a politician's convenient scapegoat to virtually anything these days. Music plays into just about every culture war there seems to be lately. This next example, though, is a little different because this incident started something in political circles that's become its own meme of sorts. Sister Souljah is an author who, back in the early 1990s, became a member of the rap group Public Enemy with Chuck D and Flavor Flav. She did a lot of the speaking intros on their albums, such as Apocalypse 91, The Enemy Strikes Black. On May 13, 1992, as the Los Angeles riots were going on, Sister Souljah gave an interview to the Washington Post. Concerning the rioters, Sister Souljah said, quote, "If black people kill black people every day, why not have a week and kill white people?" End quote. On May 18, 1992, that comment became public and was met with widespread condemnation, and justifiably so, to be completely honest with you. Conservative politicians saw it as an opportunity to condemn not just Sister Souljah, but yet again, rap music in general. See, rap music still had not gained the complete mainstream following at that point that it has now. Gangster rap was a major target for conservatives, as artists like Ice-T, Body Count, and NWA, to be blunt, scared the hell out of them. So everybody right up to President George H.W. Bush used the music to demonize one sector of the population in order to appeal to their base. 1992 was a presidential election year, after all, so what Sister Souljah said played right into their plans. Here's where the twist comes in. Democratic presidential candidate Bill Clinton also saw this as an opportunity. Clinton's nickname at the time was Slick Willie, and that nickname lasted throughout his entire presidency. You think Donald Trump has issues these days? Old Slick Willie had plenty of them, let me tell you. From questionable business dealings to alleged multiple affairs, among other scandals that seemingly continue to this very day, Jeffrey Epstein. Anywho, at this particular time in 1992, Clinton was dealing with an extramarital affair scandal that threatened to derail his presidential bid, even though he was the presumptive Democratic nominee at that point. He just needed a little something-something to get people's minds off of the scandals at the time, and this Sister Souljah comment was perfect. At the time, Clinton enjoyed widespread support from people who enjoyed rap music, but he needed to appeal to more moderate to conservative voters who looked at Clinton like he was a far-left hippie and at rap music as the coming of the Antichrist. By condemning Sister Souljah's comments, he could look like he was being tough on even the people who supported him, thus making him more appealing to the general population. So, of course, Slick Willie went after Sister Souljah. Now, I'm pretty sure that this alone did not have the desired effect of changing people's minds about him, but Clinton did win the election. That actually really had more to do with the fact that the economy was cratering towards a recession at the time. However, condemning the base of your constituency for something has given way to its own political trope. So now, when a politician does it, it's called, in political and media circles, as the politician having a Sister Souljah moment. And now you know where the phrase comes from, and how it entered the political lexicon. When the Washington Post printed Sister Souljah's comments that led to presidential candidate Bill Clinton condemning her, May 18th, 1992. Before we go any further, we'd like to tell you about our other podcasts. The Music History Today podcast goes over the daily events in music history and drops daily, including weekends, on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. There's also the Music Halls of Fame podcast, which talks about a member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, along with other Music Halls of Fame's museums and walks of fame. The Music Halls of Fame podcast drops every Thursday and can also be found on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to this podcast. Certain dates in music are happy and life-changing. For instance, February 9, 1964, when the Beatles appeared on the Ed Sullivan TV show and kicked off the British invasion. Some dates, unfortunately, are pretty sad. February 3, 1959, when the plane that Buddy Holly, the Big Bopper, and Ritchie Valens were in crashed, immortalized as the day the music died. April 5th is a sad day for fans of 90s grunge music, as that was the date when Kurt Cobain of Nirvana and Lane Staley of Alice in Chains died, exactly 8 years apart. May 18th turned into one of those days, as two men took their own lives in the exact same way, exactly 27 years apart. Both left us far too soon, and both left behind an amazing legacy of music that still lives on. Let's talk about the first one. Ian Curtis was born in England on July 15, 1956. As a child, he was very gifted, especially as a poet. Unfortunately, he was also very bored in school and constantly got into trouble. He was caught shoplifting records and also stealing prescription pills from elderly people and selling them to his friends. On June 4, 1976, Ian went to a Sex Pistols show in Manchester, England. That particular show would impact a lot of people who went. In fact, some of the people who went ended up so inspired that they formed their own bands that went on to change music, such as the Smiths. We'll talk about that concert in another episode in a couple of weeks, but what's particular to this episode is that this concert was where Ian met Bernard Sumner and Peter Hook. They all decided to start a group together, found a drummer for the group, and called it Warsaw Pact, then Warsaw, and then changed its final name to Joy Division. Joy Division had a very brief run of two major label releases. Their music was moody and ushered in the post-punk era of British music. Ian's style was quiet and his dancing was a bit strange, but people couldn't stop looking at him on stage. What people didn't realize at the time was that Ian was suffering from seizures. In fact, he would sometimes have seizures even while on stage and would have to be taken off for treatment. Ian, however, was also suffering from depression, which got especially bad in 1980. Add to that a failing marriage, and you had a recipe for implosion. On May 17, 1980, while going through his divorce, Ian went to visit his soon-to-be ex-wife. After talking with her, he asked her to leave the house for a little while. When his wife came back in the morning of May 18, 1980, she found Ian in the kitchen. He had committed suicide overnight by hanging himself. Ian Curtis was 23 years old. As far as the legacy goes, Joy Division remains one of the innovators of the post-punk revolution that happened in the 1980s. Groups like The Cure and Depeche Mode followed their style and became huge. As far as the rest of Ian's bandmates went, they remained together and changed the name of the band to one that you've probably heard of, I'm sure. The band is called New Order. Now, to the second person. Chris Cornell, born Christopher John Boyle on July 20th, 1964, rose to fame as the lead vocalist, rhythm guitarist, and lyricist for the bands Soundgarden and Audioslave. His extremely powerful, nuanced vocals became a signature of the grunge movement back in the 1990s. Chris's musical journey began in Seattle, Washington, where the burgeoning grunge scene fostered his talent. Chris co-founded Soundgarden in Seattle in 1984. Their early sound, which was a blend of heavy metal and psychedelia, evolved into a signature grunge style characterized by distorted guitars, driving rhythms, and socially conscious lyrics. Cornell's soaring vocals, ranging from aggressive growls to more soulful serenades, became a defining element for the band. Soundgarden gained critical acclaim in the late 1980s, releasing influential albums such as Ultra Mega OK and Louder Than Love. The band's commercial breakthrough came in the early 1990s, coinciding with the rise of grunge. Their album, Bad Motorfinger, featured the iconic singles Outshined and Rusty Cage, solidifying their place among grunge's Big Four alongside Nirvana, Pearl Jam, and Alice in Chains. Cornell's songwriting often delved into themes of alienation, addiction, and societal ills. Singles like Black Hole Sun and Spoon Man showcased his ability to craft catchy hooks with cryptic, thought-provoking lyrics. Soundgarden broke up originally in 1997 with the usual creative differences. Cornell then joined up with former Rage Against the Machine members when their lead singer, Zach De La Rocha, left the group. Together, Chris and Rage formed the group Audioslave, achieving further critical and commercial success. In 2010, Soundgarden reunited, embarking on tours and releasing new music. Despite his achievements, though, Chris battled a personal demon, same as Ian, depression. He openly discussed his struggles with substance abuse, a challenge he overcame, but one that would resurface later in life. On May 18, 2017, Chris Cornell was found dead in his Detroit hotel room just hours after playing his last show with Soundgarden. The official ruling was suicide by hanging, same as Ian Curtis. His death, though, sparked a lot of debate. Well, because while his history with depression was well known, his family disputed the whole suicide narrative. A lawsuit alleged that prescription medication might have played a role in his decision to hang himself. That theory is very conceivable, depending on which prescription drugs he was taking at the time. The music world was rocked by Cornell's sudden death. It would unfortunately lend itself to at least one more musical death. When Chris's good friend, who was distraught over Chris's death and who also suffered from depression, lead singer Chester Bennington of the group Linkin Park, hung himself literally 2 months later on what would have been Chris's 53rd birthday, July 20th, 2017. Chester Bennington was 41 years old at the time. Chris Cornell is remembered as one of the greatest rock singers of all time, a lyricist who plunged emotional depth and an artist who defied genre limitations. Despite the personal struggles that ultimately led to his passing, Chris Cornell's legacy with Soundgarden remains undeniable and untouchable. Their music continues to inspire generations of musicians and rock fans, a testament to the enduring power of his voice and the band's groundbreaking sound. And honestly, they should all be into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, along with Joy Division and New Order, but I digress. Chris's music and his voice continues to be a testament to a life that was tragically cut short, but forever etched in the annals of rock history. The death of Ian Curtis of Joy Division, May 18, 1980. The death of Chris Cornell of Soundgarden and Audioslave, exactly 27 years later, May 18, 2017. Fleetwood Mac started in 1967 as an offshoot of the band John Mayall and the Blues Breakers, which was the band that Eric Clapton got his start in. The Blues Breakers at the time consisted of Mayall, guitarist Peter Green, who replaced Clapton in the band, drummer Mick Fleetwood, and bass player John McVie. Green decided to form a new band and eventually took Fleetwood and McVie with him, adding guitarist Jeremy Spencer with bassist Bob Brunning joining in for a few gigs. The band went through a large number of lineup changes. Green himself ended up leaving the band in 1970 as drugs started to take their toll on him. Christine McVie officially joined the band, and the band started changing their sound and straying from the blues. A few more lineup changes in the mid-1970s, including the arrival and departure of singer Bob Welsh, netted them eventually guitarist Lindsey Buckingham, who would only join the band because they agreed to let his girlfriend Stevie Nicks join. It was at that point that the now classic Fleetwood Mac lineup was solidified. Fleetwood Mac's 1975 album Fleetwood Mac was the first album to have the now classic lineup of Mick Fleetwood, John McVie, Christine McVie, Lindsey Buckingham, and Stevie Nicks. The album was recorded in January and February of 1975 at Sound City Studios in Van Nuys, California. From the beginning, there was all sorts of tension. First, Buckingham and Nicks were romantically involved at the time they joined the band, but they were on the verge of breaking up. Second, Buckingham tried teaching everybody their parts, which didn't exactly sit well with Mick Fleetwood or John McVie. A lot of the songs on the album were already written by the time Buckingham and Nicks joined in. However, Buckingham would especially leave his mark on the album. He co-wrote World Turning with Christine McVie and wrote I'm So Afraid and Monday Morning. Stevie wrote the classic songs Landslide and Rhiannon along with Crystal. Christine McVie wrote another hit song off the album, Say You Love Me. And while all five members of the band played their instruments on the album, there was only one additional musician, veteran session musician and guitarist Waddy Wachtel, on the song Sugar Daddy. Fleetwood Mac, the album, was released in July of 1975. The album hit number one on Billboard's albums chart and stayed in the top 10 for 37 weeks. It hit top five in four other countries and became the second biggest album in America in 1976 and the 10th biggest album of 1977. It yielded the hits Over My Head, Rhiannon, and Say You Love Me. Landslide was never officially a hit, but has since grown into a classic due to other artists covering the songs like the Smashing Pumpkins. On May 15, 1975, in El Paso, Texas, 2 months before the official release of the album, Fleetwood Mac started their tour in support of the album with the now classic lineup of Mick, John, Christine, Lindsey, and Stevie. Right after their 1975 self-titled album set the classic lineup, their 1977 album Rumors turned Fleetwood Mac into superstars. That's the album, by the way, where Mike Myers joked in the movie Wayne's World about being the album they gifted you once you moved to the suburbs. The album Rumors became one of the biggest selling albums of all time, with claimed sales of over 50 million copies worldwide, 19 million in America alone. The classic lineup continued their successful run through the 1980s into the 1990s with albums such as Tusk, Mirage, and Tango in the Night. The band saw the classic lineup break up, do successful solo projects, especially Lindsey Buckingham, who had the hits Holiday Road, Go Insane, and Trouble, and Stevie Nicks, who was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame for her solo career. The lineup would famously get back together again in 1996 for now President Bill Clinton's inauguration. Yep, Slick Willie. They also did a reunion album and then they broke up again. Recently, Buckingham was let go and Mike Campbell from Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers and Neil Finn from Split Enz and Crowded House joined for a time. But despite pleas from the public to get the classic lineup back together again, those dreams unfortunately came crashing down on November 30th, 2022, when Christine McVie passed away at the age of 79 from a stroke that was caused by cancer. Overall, the band is one of the biggest selling bands of all time with sales of over 100 million albums. The classic Fleetwood Mac lineup played their first concert together in El Paso, Texas, on May 15th, 1975. Next, The Police were one of the biggest bands to come out of the post-punk era in England. Their mixture of pop, punk, and reggae, along with thoughtful lyrics, gave them 5 multi-platinum albums and scores of hits. Gordon Sumner was a former schoolteacher who was in the jazz fusion band Last Exit when he met drummer Stuart Copeland up in Newcastle, England. The two hit it off, and when Sting moved to London, the two got together and started jamming. Soon, they decided to start the band The Police. The guys got Henry Padovani, who was the guitarist for the group The Corsicans, to be their guitarist. While the guys were getting The Police going, Sting was also in a group called Strontium 90. Stuart would sit in sometimes and play drums with that group, and it was there that the guys met guitarist Andy Summers. Impressed by his playing, they asked him to be The Police's second guitarist. He said yes, but he really wanted to be the only guitarist. Sting and Stuart weren't exactly thrilled with kicking Henry out of the band, but after a couple of gigs as a quartet, Henry was eventually let go, unfortunately for Henry. The group, now a trio, released their debut album Outlandish D'Amour in 1978. The album yielded the hits Roxanne, Can't Stand Losing You, and So Lonely. The first two hits were sort of banned by the BBC, which is to say that they couldn't be played at certain times of the day. No matter, the songs were big hits because how much street cred can a new band get than to being banned by the BBC of all things? Their next album, 1979's Regatta de Blanc, had the hits Walking on the Moon and Message in a Bottle. While the album hit number one in Great Britain, they were hard-pressed to find much success in America. Outlandish only got top 25 on the Billboard Albums chart, while Regatta didn't even crack the top 40. The band finally broke through in America with the 1980 album Zenyatta Mundatta. That album had the top 10 American singles Da-Doo-Doo-Doo-Da-Da-Da and Don't Stand So Close to Me. What helped the album at this point was MTV, which had just come onto the scene by that point. The Police's music videos gave them the exposure they needed to crack the American market. Their next album, Ghost in the Machine, furthered their ambition with the hit song Every Little Thing She Does Is Magic and Spirits in the Material World. The Police really hit their peak with their next album, which was Synchronicity. The lead single from that album was written by Sting. It is one of the most misunderstood songs in rock music history. Not for its words, but for its subject matter. The song is actually about a stalker, but people everywhere think to this very day that it's a love song. Sting says that people still will come up to him and say that they had their babies made to that song, which to Sting kind of makes him cringe a little. Sting wrote the song in 1982 while staying at James Bond author Ian Fleming's GoldenEye estate in Jamaica. Sting was going through a divorce at the time, but says that he was also thinking about government and media surveillance. He only realized after the fact how creepy the song sounded, even though it sounded like a love song. Sarah McLachlan actually had the same problem with her song Possession, which is actually about a man who stalked her before he took his own life. But it still, to this day, sounds like a love song. The demo of the song was recorded at Utopia Studios in London, England. It was then worked on between December 1982 and February 1983 at George Martin's Air Studios on the island of Montserrat, where they were working on the Synchronicity album. Hugh Padgham did producing duties for this album. They tried the song out in a bunch of different styles before settling in on the final pop version. Andy Summers came up with a guitar riff while listening to composer Béla Bartók. They took 6 weeks to perfect the snare drums and the bass, with overdubs on the drums being with the Oberheim DMX drum machine, a Tama gong drum, and the snare drum. The piano was added to the bridge part to give the song that little extra added punch that it needed. The music video also helped this song achieve its popularity. directed by Godley and Cream. The video is a black and white video that uses a lot of shadow effects and imagery. The music video turned out to be one of the most recognizable music videos ever to be made and won a lot of awards. The song itself was released on May 20th, 1983 and raced up the charts, landing at number one. It was nominated for 3 Grammy Awards. Unfortunately, it ran into a buzzsaw of an album and a ton of songs by Michael Jackson and Thriller, which we talked about earlier. And that album ran roughshod over the various award shows that upcoming award season, which virtually locked out this album and this song. The song had further life when Sean Combs heavily sampled the song for his tribute song to the Notorious B.I.G. titled I'll Be Missing You. Sting even graciously sang the song with Sean during a Grammy ceremony. What was Sting not so gracious about, and rightfully so? The fact that Sean Combs sampled Sting's song without Sting's permission. Combs has to give up royalties on the song, which last figure I saw meant that Sting was making $2,000 every single day on average just from Combs's version, let alone the Police's original song. For those of you trying to do the quick math in your head, that means that Sting makes $730,000 a year in royalties just from Combs's version of the song. Just because Combs didn't ask first to use the song. And there's a lesson in there for you budding DJs and artists and producers. Don't steal someone's song. Do the professional courtesy thing and at least ask first. The song has been estimated to contribute to at least a quarter of all of Sting's song royalties and is one of the most played songs on radio, even to this day. The Police broke up after their Synchronicity tour due to infighting, shocker, especially during the making of this particular song, but they did get back together for a 151 concert reunion tour in 2007 and 2008, and they are still considered one of the greatest bands of the 1980s. The Police's iconic song, Every Breath You Take, released on May 20th, 1983. Finally, we celebrate the life of Jeffrey Ross Hyman. Who's Jeffrey Hyman? Well, he was born in Queens, New York. Like a lot of kids, Jeffrey grew up an outsider, but always wanting to play in a rock and roll band, he idolized Pete Townsend of The Who. Once out of school, in 1972, Jeffrey joined a band called Sniper. He was in the band for a couple of years until 1974, when he left to start his own band with a few of his friends from the old Queens neighborhood. They played clubs on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. One club in particular would help them and a few other bands become some of the most influential bands in music. The group had a string of albums and started the American punk music scene. At that point, the poster boys or punk, the Sex Pistols, hadn't broken through quite yet. So, together with these other bands at this particular club, they became legends. The group even played Lollapalooza in 1996, which would turn out to be their final performance. Jeffrey passed away 5 years later. If you want to look for the club where the band made its name, its location is now a clothing store, which actually did the club justice by keeping a lot of the decorations intact. The club's name's rights were bought and reopened in, of all places, Las Vegas. The club? CBGB's. All of the members of this band have since passed on, all way too young. The music scene that Jeffrey's band ruled is still out there. In fact, one of the groups, Blondie, is still going strong to this day. The other groups are still milling about in one form or another. Iggy Pop and the Stooges, the members of the Talking Heads, and such. If you would like to visit Jeffrey's gravesite, you can actually find it over in New Jersey under the name Hyman. Do not go looking for it under the name you know Jeffrey Hyman as. Joey Ramone, of the legendary punk rock group The Ramones, who was born on May 19th, 1951. And that is it for the Music History In-Depth podcast for May 15th through the 21st. Thanks for listening.